have a seat, please.
And last but certainly not least, we have Coney versus Commonwealth. And I don't have to ask you all if you've signed in. I know you have. And Mr. Hayden, a familiar query. Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
5 minutes, Sean.
Yes, sir.
May it please the court. My name is Charles Hayden. I represent Larry Eugene Coney Jr., who was convicted of second-degree murder and aggravated malicious wounding in the Hampton Circuit Court and bench trial. He received a sentence of 40 years in prison with 17 years suspended, leaving him with a net active time of 23 years, both sentences running concurrently with each other. They have assigned his error that that the evidence was insufficient to prove that that Mr. Coney committed.
Am I correct to state that the thrust of your argument is based on Christian, that the
That's
trial
true.
Court
very heavily on that.
Couldn't have eliminated others that had access
right.
to the child?
Right. In that case, the Virginia Supreme Court had a case where a mother was left in the custody of a child overnight of the parent. So she was left with him overnight. Then the following day, a daycare worker notices that there are injuries to that toddler child. And the Court of Appeal said, well, she had opportunity, certainly, during that night that she was alone with the child, but at least five other persons had access to the child as well before the injury was discovered. I would submit that this case is very similar. I really essentially quoted language out of the Christian case, really trying to track the language of it because it was so right on point, it seemed to me. And they noted their mere opportunity to commit an offense raises only the suspicion that the defendant may have been the guilty agent. But suspicion is never enough to sustain a conviction. Opportunity is always
relevant. Here, the trial court made factual findings that excluded the mother and excluded the roommate.
Well, I don't know how we exclude the roommate. We have, for example, the mother concedes that that Essex Riles, the roommate, was there when she left that Sunday morning.
At least she assumed he was there. His door was closed.
Right.
When she returned, it was open and he wasn't there.
Right. And it was his apartment. They had been a guest there for the weekend. She assumed that he was there. And so when she gets back, he was not there. She concedes he might have been there, might have left just 5 minutes before she got back. She didn't know. But there's clearly a second person in the apartment who had access to that child. And of course, we had Ms. Simmons' statement that the defendant told her, Coney told her that he initially told her, he said, well, I was just, I was there in the apartment all day. But the next day, talking again, he starts to speculate about other possibilities of maybe. He says, I don't know how the child got hurt, but he says, there was one period that I left the apartment when I went out to get cigarettes. And according to Ms. Simmons, he says that he told her that he was reluctant to tell her about going out because he was essentially leaving the child alone in the care of a stranger just to go out and get cigarettes at the convenience store.
That occurred before mother spoke with both Mr. Coney and the child, though, didn't it? Where she spoke with them at some point during the course of the afternoon, and her child sounded as though he was thriving.
Well, we don't know. We know that the mother spoke at 2:15 by phone with the child, and everything appeared okay then. And the mother doesn't get back until approximately 7:10, or possibly as early as 6:48, but 7:10 is kind of at was definitely the latest point that she would have arrived at the apartment. So it's about a 5-hour period where that has to be accounted for. And apparently, we don't know when Essex Riles left the apartment. We don't know when the defendant left to go get cigarettes from the store and left them in the care of Essex Riles, according to the defendant, according to a statement he gave to Ms. Simmons.
And that statement didn't have to be accepted by the fact finder.
It doesn't have to be, but certainly there is a failure to account for Essex Riles' whereabouts. We do have a fact that Essex Riles appears to be in the apartment behind the closed door to his bedroom when she leaves that morning and is no longer there when she arrives back in the evening with his bedroom door open. So one would have thought the Commonwealth would call Essex Riles to stand to try to exclude the possibility that maybe he was the person to have interest. So I didn't do anything to the child. I was never alone with the child.
Is there any evidence that Riles was ever a caretaker of the child or had ever been alone with the child?
The only evidence that he would have been alone with the child was the statement that Coney made to Clotilia Simmons, Ms. Simmons, that during the phone call, he speculated about how maybe the child got hurt. He says, "Well, there was one period when I went to go out to the store, the convenience store, to buy cigarettes, and perhaps something happened during that time." And she asked, "Why didn't you tell me about that going out?" And he says, he tells her he didn't want her to think that she was irresponsible. Ms. Simmons said...
He later said to her, too, that he wanted to have a chance to talk with her and tell her what really happened. He said that to Ms. Simmons.
She asserted, Ms. Simmons. There's no police. There was only one person that lied to the police about whereabouts, and that was the mother. She came up with this elaborate story about how she was alone all day with the child, and the child appeared to be fine all day, and then when she went to take a shower around 45 in the evening, she came back from the shower and she's noting then that the child seems to be in some kind of convulsions.
And she said she did so at Mr. Coney's request. Is that right?
After the fact, but she's the only person that lied to the police and the social workers and maintained this lie. It was not until they confronted her with the fact that your child's not going to live, someone's going to be charged criminally. Then she changed her story to, disregard what I told
you. Who resolves that, Mr. Hayden?
That is a trial of fact, but certainly we have, as far as the defendant, he was never making statements to the police that were contradictory statements or confessions or admissions of guilt. All we have here is opportunity of Mr. Coney to commit the offense. He was the person that was with the child most of the day. And so just like the mother in the other case was with the child most of the time. And when he talks to the police officer afterwards, and a police officer asks him to come meet with him and show up, Coney instead he says he'll come meet with him, but then doesn't show up and in fact goes to New York. But the officer acknowledged that Coney was aware of the fact that he had outstanding arrest warrants from Williamsburg and from York County from the previous month, and he was aware of that, and he would likely be arrested if he actually did show up to meet with him. He may have fled because of those outstanding warrants. We can't simply assume.
But it's an inference that was left with the fact finder to make, just like the statements that Mr. Coney made about having messed up and that he was sorry and wanted to explain what really happened to Ms. Simmons. Those are statements that was left to the fact finder to determine whether or not those were self-incriminating.
Right. But certainly this case is like the Christian case in that they noted that if the evidence had been the mother was the sole person in the care of that child, then maybe in that situation, opportunity, the circumstantial evidence that she had opportunity, but she was the sole person having opportunity, that then would be conclusive evidence of her guilt.
But in Christian, it was uncontroverted that at least five people connected with the center had access to the child. Here, the fact finder eliminated the only other two people that could possibly have injured this child. And then his story about there was a bunch of guys outside and probably and they walked in, they could have done it, that was rejected as preposterous.
All right. But how, on what basis could the trial judge possibly exclude the possibility? What evidence could he say that Essex Riles didn't have access to the child
or was never alone with the child? The appellant never said that his roommate had anything to do with it. It was the guys in the hallway.
It was the testimony of Ms. Jones that Essex Riles was also in the apartment. It was the testimony of Ms. Simmons that Coney told her that he left the child in the care of Essex Riles while he went out to get cigarettes. So he had two different sources. And what basis does the judge says, I exclude the possibility that Essex Riles could have possibly done it, when Essex Riles, the Commonwealth, had the burden of excluding this reasonable hypothesis? They failed to call the person to testify at the trial, and so the judge is making a ruling in the absence of any evidence. How do you exclude and say Essex Riles never had the opportunity or was never left alone with the child when he doesn't know it? There's no evidence in the record to draw that, make that ruling. It's impossible for the judge to have made that ruling. The evidence was the guy might have been right there with the child up in the apartment right up to 5 minutes before the mom arrived.
Is it reasonable for the fact finder to conclude that that the defendant said that he messed up, that he wanted to surrender?
He might have said that he
That he had told the mother to lie about who had control over the child during the day. Aren't those all factors?
It's a factor.
Because if he did it, does it make any difference that the roommate might have had part to do with it?
The mother is the source of the information that he tells her to lie, and she only comes up with that story after she has clearly admitted she's been lying.
But we keep having this conversation all the time. That's the role of the fact finder, not an appellate court.
Your Honor, there is all the judge can say here is that Mr. Tony had opportunity, and when he says he's done it, he's sorry for what he did. He might have been referring to sorry for having left the child in the care of this stranger, Essex Riles. It was a dumb decision to leave the child with a stranger, but it's not necessarily
an explanation. But there are others too, like he did it.
Well,
fact finder is entitled to make whatever reasonable inferences there is from the testimony.
We have certainly there's opportunity. You had the opportunity to do something to a child during this time, but it certainly the Commonwealth's evidence failed to meet its burden of showing how who hurt the child through either incriminated statements or physical evidence or something showing that linking the defendant to having actually committed. All they show is opportunity. And, well, he's the most likely suspect, just like the mom was the most likely suspect in the other case. And they failed to exclude the possibility that maybe Essex Riles did. There's no way that that I can see that the trial judge could have excluded Essex Riles as well. And the mother himself admits that she was alone with the child on two occasions before the doctors arrived, or before the medics arrived. She says that she initially arrives at the apartment, goes alone into the back room. She says he's mad with the defendant. Well, we assume that, well, he's mad with her. He must have hurt the child. Well, it's possible that she's mad with him and she hurts his child in retaliation. But so she admits that she was alone with that child for a period of time before she comes back out and out into the living room and talks to Coney and says, now I want you to leave the apartment to go to the the store to get Tylenol for the child. And so then he, Mr. Coney leaves at her request to get the Tylenol. And she tells the person on the 911 call, she says, "I'm here alone with the child. I've sent out Coney to get, and I'm alone with." So clearly during this time, she's alone with the child. So there's two people there that the evidence clearly establishes had been in the apartment. And there's evidence to suggest that were both of those persons had periods of time when each one was alone with the child. Evidence not excluded by the Commonwealth. It's not flowing from the imagination of defense counsel. It's just flat out evidence that's in the case that the Commonwealth's evidence failed to exclude of the reasonable hypothesis. Maybe one of those persons during the time they were alone committed this offense. It's all they have is opportunity, and then the defendant goes up to New York. That's all we have here. I would submit. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Kame.
Good afternoon again. May it please the Court, Aaron Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. This is obviously not a case of mere opportunity. This is a case, let me point out first, the issue is criminal agency. The argument that two other individuals could have committed this crime was submitted to the trial court, and those hypotheses of innocence were rejected. Obviously, the court understands that whenever a hypothesis of innocence is rejected, it is a finding of fact that is binding on this court unless plainly wrong. We would submit that it was not plainly wrong for the trial court to reject the defendant's
In other words, is there some evidence to support the trial court's finding?
Yes, and there was definitely more than ample evidence to support the trial court's finding. Let me just walk through it real quick. The mother, the trial court had the benefit of hearing her testify and her testimony about what happened when she got home from work. The trial court obviously accepted that testimony to find that she did this. This court would have to, one, overturn a credibility determination by the trial court, and two, view the evidence in the light most favorable to the defendant, which is this court cannot do.
Appellant argues that there was no evidence to support trial court's finding that the roommate, to exclude the roommate as a perpetrator. Would you tell us what the underlying facts were for that decision?
Sure. As for the roommate, the evidence was that the roommate may have been there that morning, and he was not there when the mother got home that night. That's it. We have the defendant telling the victim's grandmother that in one of his stories that he had left for the store and left the child with the roommate. And then possibly a group of individuals that were outside the apartment may have entered and done this to the child. I think the trial court definitely has a basis to reject that story because later he has a conversation with the grandmother where he tells her, "I want to tell you what really happened." He says, "I messed up." And then he a number of times said that he wanted to turn himself in to the police. So just on that basis, I would say that the trial court had a basis to reject the argument that the roommate could have done this. This is not like the Christian case where there was actual evidence of five different people handling the victim in the case. This is also not like the Christian case. In that case, it was simply a mere opportunity. One of the quotes that opposing counsel has left out from the Christian case is this. It says, "Opportunity is always a relevant circumstance, of course, and when reinforced by other incriminating circumstances, maybe is sufficient to establish criminal agency beyond a reasonable doubt." This is not merely a case of mere opportunity. There was other incriminating circumstances, and one is that the defendant had a motive to do this because he was in an argument with the mother that afternoon. And more importantly, immediately when the child is taken to the hospital, the defendant tells the mother to lie for him and say that the victim was with her the whole day. Obviously, he's wanting to cover something up by doing that. And then he has these series of phone calls with the victim's grandmother, where at first he says he didn't know what happened, and then he makes up this story about going to the store, and there's guys in the hallway. And then he calls her, and he's crying, and he tells him he wants to turn himself in to the police, and he's asking her if he could still call her, which suggests that there is some remorse there, and that he is quite incriminating. And then finally he calls her and tells her that he wants to talk to her and tell her what really happened and that he messed up. We also have a situation, the appellant said that he didn't make any incriminating statements to the police. Well, he did talk to the police and told them he was going to turn himself in at a certain date in a certain place. Didn't show up. He fled the state and was picked up in New York. Obviously, flight is a circumstance that is suggestive of guilt. So just to recap, he had the opportunity, he had the motive, he asked someone to lie for him, he made a number of incriminating statements, and he also fled when he said that he was going to turn himself in for this crime. I would submit that under these circumstances, this was more than sufficient, and that the court should affirm. Unless there are any questions.
Thank you very much. All right, we will come down to Greek Council, and then we'll be in recess.
All right.